So, welcome everybody to our FinStick podcast. That is the Financial Systems Thinking Innovation Centre. And I'm delighted to be joined today by Nick Robbins, who is the Professor in Practice of Sustainable Finance at the Grantham Institute, which is part of the London School of Economics, and is a former co-director of the UNEP, that's the UN Environment Programme's Inquiry into Sustainable Finance. Welcome, Nick.
Thanks very much, Nico. Delighted to be on this.
And so this is obviously to talk about systems thinking in finance. And I know there's a lot of potential topics that we could cover there. But I wondered if we could start maybe by just asking you kind of where did you first learn about systems thinking? Where were you first intrigued by those two words coming together?
Well, I think systems thinking has always been in the background, let's say, of the work I've been doing on sustainable finance, which goes back actually to the early 1990s. But it really came to life around the time of the global financial crisis, or as my Indian friends call it, the North Atlantic financial crisis in 2007-2008. I think for a number of reasons. Firstly, the financial system was not behaving as expected. It was not behaving in terms of tending towards equilibrium. It was clear that actually the market wasn't operating in an efficient way, and there were major questions about the fundamental operation of the financial system. Alongside that, we also did have rising concerns about the implications of critical sustainability issues, most notably climate change, but I think increasingly also issues around inequality, and how they impinged not just on individual portfolios in the financial system, or indeed individual financial institutions, but actually the system as a whole. So it was really that integration of a recognition that the financial system we had in the early part of the 21st century was not behaving as expected, was tending more towards instability, and how were we actually going to bring these critical environmental and social issues into the heart of sort of financial system design? So that's really, really brought it to life for me.
But do you think then that the global financial crisis, sorry, the North Atlantic, I've not heard that one before, that's good. The North Atlantic financial crisis, do you think that kind of brought things to a head, but essentially it revealed, the tide went out, and in the words of Warren Buffett, it revealed that people were swimming naked? Or do you think that something fundamentally changed at that point to sort of damage the system?
Well, I think maybe a number of things. One, firstly, it led to some very profound regulatory responses. Clearly, the establishment of the Financial Stability Board and sort of re-regulation on banking, but across the financial system, and I think a recognition that that the financial system had also become disconnected from the so-called real economy, from its core purpose. So that, and we're still living in many ways with the consequences of, but I think that did lead to a response. In one sense, I think it also provided a backdrop for more penetrating analysis, let's say, on the climate change agenda. And that's, for example, helped to provide the backdrop for the launch of the Carbon Tracker Initiative, which started really thinking about the relationship between all the fossil fuels reserves that we have, and which markets price as if they're all going to be developed and used, and actually the sort of systemic tension with that and the financial system. And a third, perhaps also the financial crisis, is it also, I think, did sort of actually bring to the front actually the realization that actually we have very different sort of cultures of financial system management. Very clearly, the role therefore of China becomes very important. And I think it's interesting that it was China really that put green finance and sustainable finance really onto the G20 agenda, and not, let's say, one of the more sort of traditional Western players. And I think they're thinking about actually how does the financial system sort of support their sort of long-term goal of eco-civilization, which is obviously a very, very ambitious goal, that I think also has led to broader changes. So in terms of there are sort of new voices in financial system design, particularly from China.
Great, yeah. Because I was looking through. We'll come on to the UNEP inquiry that you were strongly involved in, and I noticed sort of one of the planks, I guess, of the kind of inner circle. And I'll get you to describe it, Nick, if that's all right. But one of the kind of inner circle points is the financial system, the financial crisis. How do you think? Maybe we should start. Just could you describe the inquiry? This is into sustainable finance. Could you maybe just give us a bit of background about that?
Yeah, of course. So I mean, from sort of 2007 onwards up until 2014, I was working at HSBC, running their climate change investment focus, and that's really where these sort of agendas, which had previously been quite separate, came together. This was post financial crisis. Obviously, banks were thinking particularly about the re-regulation, their sort of financial survival, Basel III, and so on. And I was thinking about how we would drive down emissions and deal with physical impacts of climate change. And suddenly, we started thinking, well, what are the relationships between these previously highly separate worlds of let's say, Basel III and climate? So I started thinking about this at HSBC. We commissioned an early piece of research. But then UNEP, under the leadership of Achim Steiner, was also starting to recognize that perhaps this question of sort of ESG or sustainability was no longer just, again, a portfolio level issue, but actually should be also analyzed. So I switched from HSBC to UNEP for this exercise. And really what we were trying to do was essentially sort of ask the question, should sustainability be addressed at the financial system level, given the sort of backdrop of the financial crisis? And then if that was the case, how should it be done? So it was initially a two-year process, which reported in the run-up to the Paris conference of 2015. Mm-hmm. And what was extraordinary was the, I think, very bottom-up expressions of interest that we got for this around the world, from Brazil to India to China to UK to France and so on, sort of recognizing that we're at the beginning of a sort of new phase of thinking about the financial system and sustainability. So there were many things which we found simply sort of unthinkable, as I said earlier, sort of China putting green finance onto the agenda of the G20 and so on, and then the role particularly of central banks, which perhaps we'll come back to.
Yeah, and so those expressions of interest, is that as a government, those central banks and financial stability regulators, is that the banking participants themselves and the investment participants, are they involved?
Yes, so I think we were, again, I think that's one of the sort of dimensions of sort of thinking systemically about sustainable finance, is recognizing the sort of the different actors involved, and clearly, essentially, the financial institutions. So I worked particularly with the insurance sector, but also pension funds, credit rating agencies, and so sort of market participants, let's say, but also the regulatory community. And really, up until about sort of 2012 or so, hardly any central banks really were thinking about this issue. So I think that's one of the things that we I think feel very pleased with, was both those initial discussions about how does issues of climate change, sort of particularly let's say from the environmental perspective, how do these relate to the mandate of central banks and regulators? But also sort of that, I think, sort of provided some of the sort of context in which we now have initiatives such as the Network for Greening the Financial System. This is not something set up by Greenpeace. It's something set up by the Banque de France under President Macron's leadership, and now has 40 central banks thinking about what is their role in greening the financial system. And that's it's something perhaps would have been extraordinary to think about 5 years ago.
Yeah, so my sense of this story is that essentially there was an opportunity almost presented by the financial crisis to say, essentially, hey, what could be coming around the corner? You might well fix the financial crisis with Basel, number three or whatever four is, or, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But if you're not bringing in the thinking of what challenges we're facing in the 21st century, then you're just setting ourselves up to fail the next time around. So is that right? That there was essentially, there was a moment that, that, you know, the banks might be amenable to that message first coming to, is that the sense?
I think that's right. I suppose there was a recognition that, in a sense, the financial system wasn't doing what we thought it would do, putting its own rules, let's say, excluding issues of environmental or social sustainability. But also that provided the opportunity to think, well, actually, we have some of these big 21st century issues, clearly environmental, rising concerns about inequality, not just as a sort of social issue, but also how that inequality impacts and pervades through the financial system. And then obviously other challenges such as digital and so on. So what was interesting is I think there's this word that's often bandied around now, purpose, which can be, but I think there was that it did allow people, crisis sometimes allow people to sort of reflect on fundamental purpose, both as individual institutions, but also let's say the guardians of the financial system, the regulators and so on.
So this is the first positive narrative I think I managed to drive out of the global financial crisis. So I'm going to hang on to that one for a while. We'll see if we can come back to that. But essentially, if we hadn't filled up on collateralized debt obligations of underlying subprime mortgages, then we might not be in such a positive place. I won't ask you to comment on that, Nick. I'm gonna take that thought with me for the next crisis.
There are silver linings, hopefully.
So I'm getting a sense. I mean, I think the most interesting piece here is around, I guess, the theory of change. It's very easy for us to slip into thinking, you know, for instance, sustainable finance. Obviously, we should be talking to the banks. Let's just go and make sustainable finance attractive to banks. And then, you know, a sort of linear change model would be to say, well, there you go, here's a piece of work, please go and adopt it. You're saying, actually, we need to talk to the whole of the financial system, the sort of the ecology of finance. Can you maybe expand on that? Because it makes your messages, you know, they're more plural, they're more inclusive, but they're also kind of less snappy, right? So they're kind of harder to sort of pick up and create that kind of single story.
Yes, I think that's right. And I think what we've seen over the last 5 years is a very interesting and very dynamic dance between sort of different players in the financial system. So I think we've seen, in a sense, often innovators in the private sector sort of recognizing issues, let's say the implications of climate risk for their portfolios. Then sometimes that being taken up by regulators, who in turn maybe introduce sort of market-wide standards, which in turn drives financial innovation. So I think you can look at that in the design of new markets. So the green bond market, in a sense, has been sort of co-created. It's not just a sort of private sector initiative, although it's been banks and pension fund banks who've been helping issue these things and investors who've been buying them. But some of the sort of innovators have been public finance institutions such as the EIB or the IFC. And particularly, you now have in a number of countries, particularly developing countries, India, for example, securities regulators also setting standards. Importantly, not sort of going overboard in terms of over-regulation, but sort of setting out the principles and so on. So it's been a very interesting sort of dynamic between the need for sort of market innovation, but also the role of public authorities, because without a public authority regulatory involvement, you don't get these changes in practice becoming universal. They just become sort of nice niche markets. The biggest case of that, which is very live at the moment, is the EU Sustainable Finance Action Plan, which is incredibly ambitious. I was part of the sort of precursor to this high-level expert group on sustainable finance. And there you really see a sort of an extraordinary recognition about sustainable finance. You have now the sort of it's the financial authorities of the European Union which are driving this, not the environmental experts and so on, setting out sort of taxonomies for what could be sort of seen to be consensus around what green assets could be, and so on and so forth. So this is actually now being treated, I think, very much as a systemic issue by policymakers, and also with a dynamic back to sort of the financial institutions. And of course, we should not forget that this ultimately has to serve individuals. So actually, how do sort of individual customers or sort of enterprises who need the financial system at work, how are they being served by these big changes we're talking about?
I'm going to call myself a capitalist, but that might be the first time that name has really been associated with me. But I find this fascinating as a sort of capitalist, right? Because essentially, maybe a US version would be a free market version, where we would learn that if individuals demand essentially protection from climate change, an economy which faces the future in terms of recognizing the massive challenges we've got in the 21st century, that if that was required, then the free market would just serve that up, and all the government should do is try and kind of step back and get out of the way. Here I'm hearing that essentially the government needs to encourage that free market to kind of launch new products. And I'm not aware of another time, maybe outside of war, that the governments have really said, hey, we need innovation in this space, and we're going to set aside, you know, a kind of regulatory environment, potentially a tax intensive environment, incentivizing people in terms of the, you know, on the buy side as well as the sell side. This is quite a different approach, isn't it? How are you finding that sense around the world? I think I get that Europe is kind of on board. How is this landing in Americas and maybe in Japan and the emerging world?
Yeah, no, I think that's very, very interesting. And I think you're right. I think there's both a sort of, there's a clear recognition, let's say, about the risk dimension, sort of the risk to institutions, portfolios, and the financial system is clearly something that the public authorities should be doing. I think there's also a growing recognition that there are, let's say, market failures within the financial system which need to be addressed. So time horizons, misaligned incentives, disclosure and information asymmetries. And I think the point you've just touched on, Nico, is very interesting, and actually there is a role for public authorities also to stimulate financial innovation. In part, that can happen through actually sort of setting disclosure requirements. That's certainly what's happened in France. But I think the green bond market is an interesting case, where we recognize maybe that markets would not necessarily move at the scale or at the speed we need to move ahead. Now, clearly, China is a particularly strong example of that, where I think they've been particularly at the vanguard of sort of setting the sort of market standard of what is a green bond, which led to a surge of issuance in China. I think you mentioned the US. Now, clearly, you haven't had that same sort of systemic awakening even before the current president took over. But the interesting thing about the US is it is a federal system. So if you are sort of looking at the EU as a federal system, you do have economies such as California, states such as California, which are in the top five of countries worldwide, where many of these discussions are underway. The insurance regulator of California has introduced requirements for insurance companies to actually disclose their fossil fuel assets, to actually go through a stress testing process. They also have an active green bond process and so on. Interestingly, Mike Bloomberg, former mayor of New York, also the owner of the major sort of financial information company, also helped pull together a platform of financial institutions to think about sustainable finance across the US. So I think the US is somewhat different, maybe not at the federal level, but you do see individual federal reserves, again, perhaps not surprisingly, San Francisco Fed, starting to think about the implications of climate change. So I think the federal system in the US actually serves it well. Just north of the border, Canada has been through a process, and very interestingly, Toronto is very clear that they are sort of number two financial center in North America. And on this agenda, they want to be really ahead of the pack. So there is a sort of a competitive element as well, that perhaps while the US is sort of sleeping at the federal level on this, they want to steal a march. And maybe just to reflect, I think this sustainable finance, and particularly what we're talking about at the system level, is perhaps really the first ever time that a major sort of mega trend in finance is not being led by the US. It's quite a remarkable development in many ways. So finance is really, for the last 50 years, has very much been driven out of the US for obvious reasons, the size, the scale, and so on, but not on sustainable finance.
Interesting. Yeah. And then for the emerging world, are they, you know, developing economies, are they seeing, I think someone's described this to me as essentially the leapfrog strategy, which is, you know, we can look at developed economies and say, well, what are you going through? Let's get to the punchline of where you're aiming to get to, because we know you're going to be there in 5 years' time. So if we get there before you, you know, essentially that competitive advantage piece is kind of front and center. So, you know, someone like India or China essentially saying, well, we've got the power to move our market into a certain place, and it makes sense that we try and make that as green as possible. Are you getting that kind of reaction kind of from the emerging economies as a whole, or is it kind of highlights in different places?
I think so. And I think perhaps, I mean, one of the things we realized, particularly during the inquiry, is recognizing the sort of obviously the big differences between the mega emerging markets, let's say the China, the India, the Brazil, as it were, in some extent, South Africa, and then sort of more the sort of lower income developing countries. Mm-hmm. So I think on the big emerging economies, clearly China sees this very seriously. India, that there is a focus, particularly on the sort of the green bond and also the sort of the access to finance issue. But I'd say maybe our sort of developing countries to look at is Kenya, which has really stolen the march on the sort of digitization for access to finance through M-Kopa, mobile money, and so on. And that is being used as a platform to enable consumers to buy and use solar power. And I think there, from the central bank point of view, Patrick Njoroge, who's the governor there, a very clear sense of actually how these two trends go together, because clearly one of the ways in which sort of sustainable finance will be expressed in the coming decade is clearly through digitization of the economy. And so how these two things are linked, we can't really see sustainable finance without seeing the digital revolution as a whole. So one of the things Kenya's done, for example, in one of its treasury bond issues, is actually issue this through mobile. Yeah. So actually that individual ordinary Kenyan savers can put actually very small amounts into saving through treasury bonds. So that's another area where I think you could see you could see sort of progress. One of the things we might want to come up to, Nico, but obviously technologies we know is a sort of double-edged sword, that it can certainly sort of enable and empower, particularly better analytics and so on, and access, as we just discussed. But we know also that unless sustainability factors get into the code of digital, then we in many ways could be in potentially a worse off place. So we've got to work very, very carefully to ensure that all the digital systems, the robo-advisors and so on, that clear sustainability issues are encoded. Otherwise, we actually could be in a situation where we don't have that possibility for human intervention, and actually we could be actually entrenching an unsustainable financial system.
Yeah, and I think you've hit the nail on the head in terms of some of the motivation for us starting FinTech. So, you know, we've had a lot of conversation as actuaries about big data. And recognizing that it is out there, and that we need technology to bring that together and indeed you know, take us into the next phase of kind of financial evolution. The whole purpose of you know, thinking systemically is to say, actually, you know, big data requires big ideas. It requires you to be holistic. It requires you to think about the trade-offs that you're making. So you know, there's a complementarity in terms of, yes, we can program AI to go and discover any fact from unstructured data that we wish. But the question is, what do you do with that? And when you have the power to deal with 7-8 billion people's data, then actually the choices you're making at that kind of holistic level require systems thinking to be going forward. So there is definitely a kind of an opportunity for us to kind of make the case, I guess, as to how fintech should work on the basis of thinking about it in the bigger picture from that kind of holistic level.
Well, I think particularly given the focus of the actuaries, particularly around sort of public interest and actually applying the skills and expertise, particularly sort of the mathematical skills and expertise of actuaries, but doing that in a public interest point of view, because I think clearly there's a lot of interest in the sort of entrepreneurial opportunities around fintech, big data, and so on, but also sort of approaching that from a public interest perspective is very important.
Yeah, and I think that let's bring us on to the role of the actuary, because I think this is, you know, clearly we're motivated by some interesting kind of two different value systems, right? So to some extent, we are free marketeers in that we believe that, you know, actuaries have a role to go off and make profit. And indeed, if they don't sit in profitable firms, then they're probably not employed. But then we also understand that the profession as a whole has to guard that public interest. We think there's, you know, the systems thinkers, we're missing a few kind of link concepts here. So I think public interest is kind of one framing of a word which I'd put back to you maybe to help us define, which is sustainability. So that there's something about public goods, or there's something about creating capitals. There's all sorts of different narratives available to us. What's your kind of take on maybe the what a workable definition of sustainability might be, or maybe even what the better word to call those things would be?
Well, I mean, I think maybe there are sort of two ways of thinking about it, particularly, I mean, if we think about the way actuaries sort of provide a very essential sort of service to understand the sort of uncertainties of the future as they apply to sort of different financial products and different financial institutions. So I think, in a sense, this should be the age of the actuary, sustainability. And I think perhaps into two aspects. One of the things that is very clear now is that the financial world has particular problems around time horizons, and as we know, many of the issues around sustainability, maybe environment issues, but also sustainable issues, sort of crystallize over the long term. And Mark Carney coined the famous phrase, the tragedy of the horizon, that actually by the time we will realize that some of these things will be material into market prices, actually it may be too late, particularly with the reversal issues like climate change. But I think there's a clear role for actuaries to work with their clients, advise their clients, in the sort of new suite of tools that have been thought about in terms of scenarios, particularly again for climate change, in terms of actually large asset owners as well as corporates and banks being asked to test their business models against scenarios both of sort of climate collapse but also of a transition to a zero carbon economy. Stress tests that's coming in. The Bank of England here in the UK is applying, will be applying a stress test to the financial system. And so I think all these skills, which actuaries have been applying for many decades, there's a sort of new generation to be thinking with a recognition about some of the limitations of traditional sort of economic models. Nick Stern here at Grantham, I think, has very profoundly identified that actually most macroeconomic models, which are obviously only one input, let's say, for the work of actuaries, but actually they underestimate the risks of climate change because some of the issues around climate change are hard to price. And often they also underestimate some of the benefits of sort of innovation-led growth, which, for example, we've been seeing through the growth of the renewables industry, which every mainstream forecaster has underappreciated. So I think there's that sort of serving clients through these sort of forward-looking tools. But then there's another issue, which maybe touches on your public interest, is actually, I think one of the challenges in the sort of in the way we look at the financial system is that there are clearly huge benefits for participants in the financial system, whether that's consumers of financial products or indeed providers of financial products, in a healthy and stable and functioning financial system. And yet, there's actually very, very little sense of how you contribute to that through your actions. How, as an individual financial institution, as a pension fund, are you actually not just getting best risk-adjusted returns for your beneficiaries, doing these? Actually, how are you contributing to system health? Yeah. How are you also sort of putting something back, as it were, not in a sort of voluntary charitable way, but actually you, and this is where we get into sort of concepts such as universal owner on the pension side, you also benefit from these wider sort of system functionings. And I think that potentially through the analytical lens is something also I think that actuaries could potentially contribute to.
Yeah, so I think it what's most challenging to the worldview that I grew up with is maybe both of those two points. Maybe I'll take them in reverse order, but that sense that we are doing anything to contribute to a system, I think, wasn't kind of particularly brought out in my actuarial education. So there's definitely a piece of work to, you know, I'd frame it around saying, you know, we're all so interconnected now. We're also, we the human species are so dominant in terms of, you know, planet Earth, that there's very little we can do which doesn't have an impact on someone else. And therefore, actually, you know, the circularity of those impacts means that we ought to be kind of more conscious of those pieces. So I think we've got to do some work to explore that as a profession. And I think we need to kind of bring better questions, really, as opposed to necessarily answers, but better questions to actuaries, you know, as a whole, and our education system to get those pieces in play. I think the piece on modelling, for me, is the heart of the, you know, maybe our contribution to systems thinking. That first piece was slightly philosophical, but may well have modelling impact. But at the heart of it, I think our models are kind of, I think we've described them as linear. So the only kind of change that you can get out of our model is essentially a compound interest incremental change. Yes, there's some stochastic volatility coming into it, but it's not a disruptive change mechanism. It doesn't have any, I'll be too economic about this, but it doesn't have any exogenous kind of shocks coming into the system.
Right.
But when we're talking about you know, new technology, and I've got Schumpeter sat on my desk, but when we're talking about kind of technology change and a view that essentially we are an emergent system and that we can, you know, all turn and face a different direction instantaneously and totally hollow out some old sector of the economy and totally face into a new sector of the economy very rapidly indeed, those aren't in our economic models. So they can lead us to underestimate the risks. And I think, as you say, underestimate the opportunities here as well, because we believe that everything is incremental, because our models are essentially a compound interest accruing methodology. So I think you've hit two really key pieces, not just in terms of how we as actuaries can help, but also the problems that we need to address as actuaries.
And I think also those issues of risk and disruptive change are also, in a sense, reflexive, as sort of George Soros has identified, that actually the actions we take also impinge on and actually can influence the nature of the risk and opportunity we face. So I think that it is a dynamic system, and I think climate change is one of these issues where I think the received wisdom, perhaps, or the market consensus in the investment world, let's say, is that this is very serious. But actually, we don't see the coordinated global action from governance and so on, and that something bad will happen. But bad will happen sort of quite a way in the future. So when it's compounded away in terms of the implications of funds. One interesting project that has just been launched by the Principles of Responsible Investment is called the Inevitable Policy Response, which is suggesting actually that there is a possibility that actually this is a sort of hard-nosed forecast, that what is likely is a delayed response, an abrupt response, perhaps in early 2020s, which could be more disruptive for investors in the financial system, which goes with the grain of some of the technological developments, let's say renewables and electric vehicles and so on. And in a sense, it's perhaps that which should be seen as the business as usual rather than as a sort of, yes, it's going to be existential for our grandchildren, but actually in the near term, it's not going to sort of really hit the market materiality. So I think there's sort of an important way about what we think is the central expectation, let's say, which of course is a judgment. But I think that is going to be one of the things that I think all financial professionals are going to have to think of. What is now your central expectation about some of these issues?
Yeah, and I think I was very taken by the inevitable policy response. We haven't seen the modelling outputs. We're speaking in mid September. I think the modelling outputs are due in the next few days. And as an actuary, I should be crawling all over them. I think that's going to be very interesting. But that kind of narrative that you've just outlined, I think it is really important to say, essentially, at some stage, governments are going to wake up to this. It's either going to be sooner or later, but this is definitely what they need to be doing and thinking about by 2050. And by the way, the later they think about it, the harder it's going to be. So I think there's a really interesting, I love your framing there, because as this is our new normal, this is the kind of base case. Because again, the challenge to the financial system is that we're taking our base case off of market observables. We're constructing a yield curve off of treasury bonds. We're constructing, you know, dividend yield assumptions based on kind of current market. And we're not kind of taking that kind of policy picture. There's a methodology challenge for us as actuaries. But I think that's going to be a really important piece of work, and right. I'm very much looking forward to seeing it. You were involved in that as well, I think.
Yes, we were doing some work actually on a sort of a related theme of the so-called just transition. So it starts with this notion that we need to move to a zero carbon economy. We need to build our resilience to the shocks of climate change already in the planetary system. But as we do that, we need to recognize that this also needs to be done in ways which delivers on inclusive growth, which I think speaks to this sort of recognition, which is on the other side of the sort of ESG coin, as it were, recognizing that inequality is also a systemic issue that we see from some of the analytics coming from the IMF and the OECD and so on, not known for their sort of radical thinking in the past, but actually recognizing that inequality can actually be a dampener on growth. And obviously, it has a financial expression because that can lead potentially to greater exposure to consumer and other forms of debt, which obviously then do have financial sort of system consequences. So the work we were doing for the inevitable policy response was essentially saying, as if we assume that the sort of core scenario or core expectation is that governments will act, but in abrupt and delayed ways, that as they do that, they'll need to be thinking about what does that mean for economies and regions that and sectors that could be impacted by that rapid change. I think often people think about sort of coal mines and coal mining districts and industrial regions of let's say the OECD, but that also affects many other sectors, the construction and retail real estate sector in a sense. All the skills that underlie that will need to be rethought and so on. So how do we actually, again, be systemic about the climate challenge? Think not just about its environmental dimension, but also about those societal dimensions as well, so that the outcome is inclusive growth, which obviously is what we're looking at from a macro point of view, but it's inclusive growth which is going to be the machine that's going to generate the returns that underpin pensions in the coming decades.
And so just remind us, Nick, that the just transition is essentially those words are part of the Paris Agreement, is that right? So there's a global commitment to think about climate change with just transition as part of that.
That's right. So the Paris Agreement, agreed in 2015, has three goals: drive your emissions down to zero, make yourself more resilient, strengthen your response to the impacts of climate change, and third is make your financial flows consistent with the two goals above. And then as you do that, consider the implications, consider the just transition, and that particularly is thinking about what that means for the world of work. What does that mean in terms of the opportunities for new jobs, higher skilled jobs, higher productive jobs, but also thinking through what does that mean for sectors that could be challenged by that. But then quickly, as you can move beyond a focus on the world of work, to obviously then thinking about what that means for communities, because jobs and particularly resource sectors are clustered in particular regions, so there's a spatial dimension. And I don't know if we have time for it, but I think we've talked a little bit about the sort of the time dimension of system change and sort of system health. But I think the spatial dimension is also one perhaps the financial system finds quite hard to deal with. So there's a sort of, what does this mean for the world of work? What does this mean for the spatial dimension? And clearly investors have committed overwhelmingly now to integrate environmental, social and governance issues into their portfolios. But generally, my sense is that these are generally in a silo mentality. That climate is an environmental issue, labor standards is a social issue, and there the twain will meet. But we know in the real world, actually, these two are very, very tightly linked. So that's the theme of the Just Transition. Here at LSE, we've been working with Harvard University, the PRI, and also the International Trade Union Confederation to actually develop a guide for investors about why this might be relevant material for investors and what they can do about it. And we have now about 140 investment institutions, about 8 trillion in assets, who are supporting a just transition, essentially sort of making that connection between the E and the S of the transition.
I think that silo point is really very interesting, because there's another silo that institutional investment is kind of working within, which is essentially the difference between a sort of investee company and a portfolio silo. So, you know, yes, there are places that will be thinking ESG, you know, there's blur and overlap, but it's really only talking to the coal mine about the implications of, you know, what they're going to have to do to pack up work and release their capital back to me about that kind of destination. It's not thinking about the kind of fact that there's another business next door that I might wish to invest in that might actually, my investment might support jobs moving from the coal mine to the next set of, you know, the next set of technologies, the next set of labor opportunities. So I think there's a silo to break down there as well. So it's actually at my portfolio level that I should be thinking about just transition.
Right.
As well as that kind of physical spatial dimension.
Yeah. And within and between different asset classes. So yes, on your listed equities portfolio, you'll be thinking about sort of whether you should be withdrawing capital, encouraging CapEx and so on in some of the big fossil fuel companies. But maybe in your unlisted portfolios, your real estate, your infrastructure, that's where you're maybe going to be bumping up against some of these issues about the sort of health of particular regional economies where your assets are deployed.
Fantastic. I get the sense, Nick, that you and I could talk about this for hours and hours, but I will attempt to close this pretty much now, but I will leave you with a kind of final thought question, if I may. So I guess the question is, do you have any comments or kind of last pieces for the financial system and specifically actuaries? Are there any kind of maybe stepping away from this and thinking about systems thinking in general? Do you have any kind of recommendations for us?
Well, I mean, I think the important piece is to recognize while we've been talking and throwing all these different factors into the analysis, and we've been building up sort of a superstructure of complexity, and people can say that this is just too hard. In the financial system, we do need to take decisions in context of uncertainty. So I think we really do need to think this as a learning process. One of the writers I found particularly useful is Otto Scharmer, who's developed this sort of theory U. And if you can think about a U, you need to sort of think about sort of moving down from the sort of status quo and sort of constantly testing. You reach a sort of a conclusion at the base, and then you quickly move up. Now, one of the themes Otto Scharmer has come up with is this notion of sort of prototyping. And I think actually it came from Intel and the technology world, is actually you don't wait until you have the perfect, but maybe you have sort of a 0.8 model, not a 1.0 model, and actually right. You test and you trial and actually you work, and which is a very scientific process. You test your hypotheses, you test your so on, and you don't wait for, in a sense, the perfect before you act, because the system is dynamic and so on. So I think that notion of sort of prototyping, I think the phrase is fast failure, which can sound sort of challenging, but actually that's the process by which we learn. So I think very much thinking sustainable finance as a learning exercise is really crucial.
Thank you. Yeah, that's a profound thought to leave us with, because I think if I was to be the psychiatrist of the actuarial profession, or indeed the financial system as a whole, then I think fear of failure would be a major thing that I'd be on the, you know, my clients would be on the couch discussing with me. So there's definitely yep. a sense that we have to be right all the time, that we are the expert in the room, and our expertise is about existing knowledge. I think what you're saying to us is actually our expertise should be about learning, and that we should be fast learners and not come in with the answer. And effectively that worldview shift, I think, will be profound. I don't fully agree it's needed. Excellent. Right, Nick, that was very good. I shall
close
the podcast there. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening in. I hope that was useful. There'll be plenty more podcasts on our website. My name is Nico Aspinall. I've been speaking to Nick Robbins, who is the Professor in Practice of Sustainable Finance at Grantham Institute, and this was a podcast for FinSIC. Thank you all.